Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear the first of two special programs presenting debates between the candidates running for nomination to the United States House of Representatives from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District in the primary election on Tuesday, May 15th. On today's program, a debate between the two Democrat candidates. The Republican candidates' debate will be heard tomorrow at 12 noon. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 23, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the candidates and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The participants in today's debate will be the current Nebraska State Senator from the 9th Legislative District, Gwen Howard, and the current Douglas County Treasurer, John Ewing. Here now to introduce the candidates is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Gary Kerr, chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. The Press Club sponsors monthly noon forums, which are open to the public. And today our noon forum is co-sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Greater Omaha and the Press Club. It is a debate between the two Democrats running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District, Omaha State Senator Gwen Howard and Douglas County Treasurer John Ewing. The winner in the May primary election will go on to face the winner of the Republican primary in the November general election. Now, each candidate will get a 2-minute opening statement, 1 minute and 30 seconds to respond to each question. And should they choose to use it, there will be 30 seconds of rebuttal time after that. Please turn off your cell phones, other electronic devices. Please no applause, cheering, hooting, etc. during the debate. But you can do that now as we invite to the podiums Gwen Howard and John Ewing. And the toss of the coin has determined that John Ewing, you will be first with an opening statement. John?
Thank you, Gary. I'm John Ewing, your Douglas County Treasurer, and I'm running for a 2nd District for the congressional race because I want you to pay close attention to this race. I won't always tell you what you want to hear, but I will always be honest with you. But I will also always figure out a way that we can work together and build consensus so that we can get things done. I am the better candidate for 3 reasons: executive experience, legislative success, and name recognition. As the Douglas County Treasurer and also as a deputy chief, I balanced 6 budgets. I've also shown great leadership working with the other treasurers across the state of Nebraska to get online services not only in Douglas County, but across the state of Nebraska. I am also saving the citizens of Douglas County over $1 million because of the efficiency that we've created in our office. When I was the lieutenant of the Special Victims Unit in 2004, I actually worked with the current Attorney General, as well as legislators, and also Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, the YWCA, and other victim advocates to be able to get 10 laws passed to protect women and children in this community in one legislative session. I also have worked hard with the unicameral in getting things done for women and children in many other areas during that time, as well as I've worked with 92 other county treasurers to get these new efforts in line to be able to get you to be able to have a more convenient experience in our office. I know right now that you have trusted me for the last 5 years with over $1.7 billion, and I would ask that you would trust me with your vote as well.
Thank you, John. Gwen Howard, your opening statement.
Thank you, Gary Kerr. I'm Senator Gwen Howard from District 9 here in Omaha, and I was elected to this position the first time in 2004 and ran on a platform of child protection, which is a background where I come from, and also issues of there was a home repair sales tax that was very detrimental to the homeowners living in my district. Since I've been in Lincoln, I've committed myself to working for the average person, the common person, making sure that our issues were represented. I've gotten numerous bills passed, and I wanted to point out that a few years ago I prioritized a bill regarding domestic violence that I'd been asked to carry in order to correct let's just say it wasn't adequate legislation in the past. And this bill was being carried by Pete Persh, senator from across party lines. And we worked together to get this passed to increase the penalties for perpetrators of domestic violence. I also put an amendment, a floor amendment, on that bill to increase the penalty for shaking infants to 30 years in prison. Now, when I ran in 2004, and probably the main reason that I took this on was that I was very concerned that children were being returned to the home where they had been abused. The focus at that time was reunification. And I said, if this is a legislation that's being passed by males, not showing the concern that we need to demonstrate for those the most vulnerable in our society, I'm going to step up and take this on. And you've supported me. I ran in 2008 without an opponent, and I've continued my commitment to you, to children, to families. And frankly, in the last 15 seconds, I'll say, here in Nebraska, we balance our budget.
Our questions were prepared by a committee of the Press Club and the League of Women Voters. The candidates have not seen them in advance. And Gwen Howard, the first question goes to you, and we got a lot of economic questions here. The annual federal budget deficit has been exceeding $1 trillion a year, bringing our national debt to around $15 trillion. Everybody agrees that it's simply not sustainable and the problem has to be addressed. So there are many ways to approach this. Let's just take a few of them individually. In general, do you agree or disagree that it will take a combination of spending cuts and tax increases to solve the problem? And what spending cuts and or tax increases would you suggest? Gwen Howard?
Well, I'll go back to the budget here in Nebraska. Those are the very issues that we've been working on, especially for the last 3 years during the recession. And we have made spending cuts, and some of them have been painful spending cuts. When the revenue is down, we have to look at how we're spending our money. On the federal level, one of the things that's very, very concerning to me is that the proposal from the Paul Ryan budget is for $150,000 in additional tax cuts to those who make the most wealthy in our society. And to me, this is the wrong way to go. We can't be granting millionaires, big oil companies, those of us in this country, now I shouldn't say us because I'm sure not included, but those in our country that have the most money, the most tax breaks, on the backs of the most vulnerable. And I absolutely oppose any reduction in our program for Social Security. My dad always said, don't mess with your safety net.
John Ewing.
I'm going to just briefly share with you that in the Douglas County Treasurer's Office, we had to cut our budget 4% each of the last 2 years. That meant that we went from 115 full-time employees to 95 full-time employees through attrition. We have made the tough choices to be able to serve you better in this community, and I will take that same commitment to Washington, D.C. I've been very clear from the day I filed for office that I would vote to raise taxes for those who make more than $1 million a year. I also have been very clear that I would look at the budget very closely to make sure that we reduce our spending where it's possible, protecting those who are most vulnerable in our society, making sure that we protect Social Security and Medicare, making sure that we protect women and children, because right now in 2012, a certain party has declared a war on women, and I believe we need to have a war for women and children in 2012. And that's what I commit to as your representative in Washington, D.C., is working to reduce the budget, looking at all of the spending that is being done in Washington, D.C., and making sure that it is spending that is fair and just for those who are most in need in this country, because we are the greatest nation in the history of the world, and we should not be balancing our budget on those who are less fortunate, those who need the help in this country. Thank you.
Now, we've got time for 30-second responses here, if you want to use them. Gwen Howard, you want on the same question?
We do have a war. Thank you, Gary. We do have a war going on against women, and I will say in our country, sadly, we are 90th in representation in the world with women in our legislative and congressional bodies, 90th. We come in behind Cuba, China, Iraq, and Afghanistan. As I say to my daughter, Sarah, it's going to take 500 years for women to receive parity to represent the issues that we care about. Thank you.
John, response?
Yes. Yes, and I will tell the people in this room that I've been a board member for Girls, Inc. for the last 7 years, and we have incorporated probably the most comprehensive sex education program of any not-for-profit in this country, because I believe it's important to make resources available to our young people to address the issues that are facing them. And I will continue to do that if I'm your representative.
We've already had some references to Social Security, that connection with our next question. When it comes to federal budget spending, about 41% of spending is for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So those are certainly places that you could look for savings. A couple of questions with regard to Social Security. Do you want the retirement age for Social Security, or should it be, raised to 68, and why or why not, John Ewing?
I do not believe that we need to raise the retirement age to 68 for Social Security. I believe that would be unfair to change that program fundamentally when at this point in time we owe Social Security and the trust fund $4 trillion. I believe what we need to be doing, instead of saying Social Security needs dramatic changes, is to look at the fact that back in the 1980s, we put Social Security into the general budget and borrowed $4 trillion from Social Security since that time. What we need to do as we look at reducing our deficit is making sure that we also pay the money back to Social Security, put Social Security in a lockbox where it cannot be touched except for the programs that it's designed to provide, and then make sure that we also look at ways to increase the return on investment of that money that's in Social Security so that we can have that program be viable into the future. There may be some other fixes as well, like removing the artificial cap of $110,100 that currently keeps high wage earners from having to pay Social Security on a portion of their wages. I believe we need to look at that. I believe we need to look at how we strengthen Social Security, and I will never vote to privatize Social Security and Medicare or do any of those changes unless it's absolutely necessary, and I come back and talk to the people of this district.
Gwen Howard.
Thank you, Gary. If we do nothing to address the problems with Social Security will continue to be funded through 2036. Now, it's unlikely that we're not going to address the possible shortfall in this, but in looking at it from my perspective, those individuals that earn or have more income than $106,000 are capped at that. They don't have to pay additional into Social Security. People say to me, we understand why we pay into Social Security. We want it to be fair. And I say to you, this should be fair. Those that earn more and have more should pay more. They should be contributing to this fund. In addition to that, the government should not be borrowing from Social Security to pay for privatized war efforts. I absolutely oppose funding going to, let's just say, Halliburton when we pay for our Social Security, and we're fighting diligently wars in two countries. Thank you.
Any response, John?
I, too, believe that we need to look at how we spend our money. Certainly, we should not be nation-building in other countries when we have a nation to build right here when it comes to our infrastructure, when it comes to taking care of the people of the United States of America.
Gwen Howard, any response?
We are taking care of people in the United States of America, but we can do a better job. We can do a better job of taking care of our own. And along with this, We can provide incentives for our businesses to return to our shores so that our workers have jobs. Offshoring and providing tax cuts for offshoring is absolutely the wrong way to go. We need our people working in our country contributing into our system. And along with that, in the last probably 10 seconds that I had, I'll say we need our people to be as well educated as possible to contribute into our system. Thank you.
You know, we got another Social Security question here. Maybe you guys have already answered most of this. I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think Social Security benefits should be lessened for people with above average incomes to help protect the future solvency of the program? And why or why not? Gwen Howard?
Thank you, Gary. This is a problem that needs to be solved by all of us. This Social Security is a promise that was made to each and every one of you. To me, when I started working for a dollar and a nickel down at the JCPenney on 16th Street in Omaha, we all had the money deducted. We all expect that when we reach an age, we're not going to be looking at going out and finding a job again, but we are going to have that safety net of Social Security. That needs to be there. Whether we look at increasing the age, we look at increasing those that pay into the system, I think that's the answer that has to be addressed. I say those that earn more should be paying into this system and supporting everyone.
John Ewing.
I believe we need to look at, as I said earlier, the fact that we have $4 trillion that we borrowed from Social Security before we make any major changes like raising the age or means testing or any of those type of things. I believe there will be a time where we may have to look at those things, but I don't believe we need to fundamentally change Social Security until we address the issue that we've taken $4 trillion out of that fund. I believe we need to pay that money back. I also believe that with Social Security and Medicare, we need to make sure that we are also recognizing that it's supposed to be a subsidy or an opportunity to help people in their retirement age and not supposed to be the entire retirement for people. So we need to make sure that we do the right tax reforms and the right incentives to encourage people to save for their retirement as well, because at the end of the day, we want people to be the best off that they can be, not just marginally getting by and hoping they get a 2% cost of living raise and things like that. America's better than that. So we give a lot of tax incentives. We get a lot of tax loopholes. But I believe what we really need to be doing is encouraging our people to invest, to save, and to prepare for their future so that this country will be able to live up to its obligations to the people. So let's encourage savings, let's encourage retirement so that you can live the best life possible.
Gwen Howard, a 30-second response, if you
like. I'll try to be quick. You know, the average couple, the average retired couple makes slightly over, or earns, receives slightly over $1,200 a month from Social Security. Now, in order to receive that amount through your personal savings, you would have had to have saved up over the course of your working years over $600,000. Now, I don't think most people can do that and raise a family and pay for a house and possibly a car. It's really unrealistic to expect that people will be able to save themselves an equivalent amount to what they have earned through Social Security. That program should stay intact. I encourage anyone to save money. I try myself. But we have to be realistic about people's incomes and people's resources.
All right, we're not done with financial questions yet. Again, with regard to the budget, revenue could be raised by changing the tax code, eliminating many tax exemptions, credits, and loopholes enjoyed by businesses and others. But to really have an impact, you would have to eliminate popular tax breaks like home mortgage interest and charitable contributions. Which, if any of these changes, would you support, John Ewing?
I would not support reducing the home mortgage deduction or charitable contributions. I believe those two in particular add economic value to this country and help those who are less fortunate, especially when you look at contributing to not-for-profit organizations. I believe there are other tax loopholes, like for the biggest Fortune 500 companies like GE and the oil and gas companies and some of the others like Apple who are outsourcing their jobs. I believe what we need to do is reduce those loopholes first, and then we look at where we're at in terms of taking away the home mortgage deduction or charitable contributions, because I believe those are actually very beneficial to our country. I believe we should look at every deduction, scrutinize it, look and see if it adds any economic value, any worth to this country. If it does not, then I believe we need to get rid of it. We should only be encouraging things that add economic value or some other type of intrinsic value, the well-being of this country, when we look at tax deductions or tax loopholes. We cannot continue down this road of allowing big business in particular and the wealthiest to be able to have deductions for things that let them shelter money but don't allow for any economic benefit to the working men and women of this country.
Gwen Howard.
Thank you, Gary Kerr. I think our timekeeper is going to have to get some luminous paint there for your signs. Absolutely, I don't support abolishing the home mortgage tax deduction or a charitable tax deduction. A few years ago, I remember Pam Redmond, a state senator, tried to bring in an adjustment to the home mortgage, and it was not well received. What we need to look at are eliminating the loopholes, the special considerations, the tax benefits for companies such as Big Oil. Now, we know that. Now, having said that, I'm going to tell you why it's so hard. I work in the legislative branch. I work in the unicameral down in Lincoln. We have lobbyists that stand in the rotunda all day long for the interests that they've been paid to represent. Now, I see it on a smaller scale down there, and I can only imagine the lobbyists that stand in the rotunda in Washington, D.C. I think we need to take a look at the payments, the money that is channeled from those lobbyists into our lawmakers so that there are restrictions and there's transparency. And I would say that's the way to begin. If you want people to represent you, we need to look at who's paying them and how much to represent them.
John Ewing, in response.
Yes, I don't make excuses. I get things done. If I go to Washington, D.C. to represent you, I don't care who the lobbyists are. I don't care who the special interests are. Just like I have as the Douglas County Treasurer, just like I have as a member of the Omaha Police Department, I will work for you and we will get things done.
Gwen Howard.
I think that's good to say. It's easy to say. But if you look at your representative in D.C. right now, Lee Terry, and the amount of money that he has taken in from lobbyists, it's an extraordinary amount. Lobbyist money talk. We need to be aware of that. We need to be realistic about that. And we need to elect people that aren't afraid to say no to a lobbyist and are willing to go down there. I've said it on the floor many times. I'm an average person. I'm down here representing the average person that trusts me to be here for them. And I followed that for 8 years. When I go home at night, I want to be okay with myself, and I want to be okay with you.
All right, let's hear your views on some social issues. What is your stand on the right to abortion, Gwen Howard?
I am a pro-choice individual. I represent on the floor down in Lincoln. Having said that, I will tell you that there are many Catholic parishes in my district. I represent a great Catholic population, and they understand that my background is doing adoption work. I am pro-adoption, supportive of adoption, and building families through adoption. We shouldn't be making the judgment about hard decisions that our sisters, our friends, our relatives may be making, painful decisions. We should be standing up and saying we offer alternatives. And I stand up and I say I offer adoption.
John Ewing.
I recognize that this is a very important issue to people all around this country, and there have been a lot of tough choices that people have to make. I'm a guy who looks at how do we build consensus. Right now in America, every year, there are 6 million pregnancies. Of those, about 3 million are unplanned pregnancies. I believe what we need to do is have a comprehensive approach to make sure we address those 3 million pregnancies so that we can help women, help young girls in particular, because I, in my past experience with the police department, saw a lot of young girls who were preyed upon by older men who ended up becoming pregnant. I believe we need to work with them. We need to try to find solutions for them and help them be able to avoid pregnancy, help them to be able to make decisions that will be the best for them. My goal is always to work and try to find consensus on an issue, even if I don't agree or you don't agree with me. My stance as a Baptist minister is I believe that all life is precious. And so what I'm going to try to do is work with women on that issue, because I believe it's important to them, but I also believe in the sanctity of life. So I'm going to ask people to look at adoption, to look at ways to prevent pregnancy, and to look at ways to work together to reduce the need for abortion.
Gwen Howard, a response?
Thank you. The first bill that I got passed after I'd been in Lincoln for 6 weeks, and you always remember your first bill, it's for me, LB 264. Was legislation to put in an early intervention program to keep infants from being hurt and going into the foster care system. And I wanted this program to go to the visiting nurses because I knew they could do an excellent job. I have a history of working with them through social work many years. And they could go into the homes, they could talk to the young mother on her own level, non-threatening, and give her the support she needs, and also provide education to prevent additional unplanned births.
John?
I will also tell you, since I didn't get a chance to finish, that I am a strong supporter of efforts and groups like Planned Parenthood that work with women and provide medical services, and would never vote to defund those particular organizations. And I also look at all of the work that is being done across the country on this issue. I also look at the mean-spirited legislation that has been proposed around this country, like what I would consider government-sanctioned rape. Most of you know about Virginia, but most of you may not know about Texas, where they are actually utilizing the probe to make women go through that process prior to an abortion. And I just don't believe those type of mean-spirited things are right.
Contraception has been a big issue recently. Question: should all employers or the insurance companies through which they provide health insurance, except for churches themselves that object, be required to provide contraceptive coverage as part of the insurance package they provide their employees? Now, that's the provision under the new health care law that has caused so much controversy, John Ewing.
Yes. To make it very short and simple, I believe that they need to provide that coverage. I also believe that churches need to have the protection that they want from a standpoint of being able to separate that from their actual insurance policy. But I believe a woman who works at a church, at a Catholic institution, at a Catholic university, needs to be able to have the same access to contraception as any other woman in this country. I believe if you don't have that, then you are treating women as second-class citizens just by virtue of where they work, and I don't believe that's fair. So at the end of the day, make it so those organizations have the resources to be able to provide that through the insurance companies or some third-party provider. But I believe they should have access to that as well.
Gwen Howard?
Thank you, Gary. The answer is yes. But this is actually a much larger question than simply contraceptives. When an employer is allowed the option to make a decision about what health care they'll cover, this is going to be extended to more than just contraceptive, which not only affects women, but also affects men. Let's be honest about that. But when this is broadened, the employer is going to be allowed to decide what coverage you will have and whether this coverage would be effective. For example, the employer could decide that a treatment that your child needs will not be approved because it's still in the experimental stage, or the employer doesn't feel that it's really going to help the child, or let's be honest, that it's expensive. We need to be very, very careful about restricting what people are able to include in their own health coverage. An employer shouldn't be able to make the decision for you about your own personal needs. Yes, I know insurance policies are complicated. You get the information and you try to figure out what you're going to need in the next year, what you should buy. But I say to you, it should be you deciding, not your employer.
John Ewing, a response?
Yes, I would agree with Senator Howard that this is a bigger issue, that we need to make sure that as we're looking at these types of issues, we don't allow employers to actually be able to decide for whatever reason, maybe it's a religious exception or whatever, that they don't believe you have a right to certain medical coverage in your insurance policy. And I believe, I'll just add this, if we're going to cover Viagra and other things for men in our health care insurance, we need to cover contraception for women.
Gwen Howard, any additional comments?
I'm going to divert a little from the contraceptive question, and I'm going to say one of the issues that we dealt with on the floor, and we really didn't come up with a solution for it, so I appreciate the Health Care Act especially, was single coverage for a child. When a grandmother takes a child but can't access just a policy for that child because the grandmother is already covered through Medicare, there was no company here in Nebraska that was willing to offer a single coverage policy. And I talked to him myself. I talked to Blue Cross. The grandmother would have to apply for our state Medicaid in order to receive coverage for that child, and that's just wrong.
You mentioned the Health Care Act. A question that along those lines, a major component of the health care law that President Obama got passed is the mandate that all Americans have health insurance. It is very controversial, as all of you know, and some groups want to repeal the mandate, if not the law in its entirety. But it is also argued, how is it different from the government mandate to carry auto insurance? Gwen Howard, the mandate.
The mandate. As you may know, our Attorney General has joined in the suit against the mandated health insurance coverage. You know, there are many things in this country that you are mandated to do. You're mandated to send your child to school. You're mandated to have a driver's license if you're going to drive a car. There are many things that are required. I see this as a very basic requirement. There are options. You make choices. And those choices you should have personally, what the coverage is, how extensive the coverage is that you choose to take. But I'm a believer in everyone participating in health care coverage. I've seen the other side of it. I've seen families and children that don't have any adequate coverage and are dependent on the system, if you will, on the Medicaid system. And that's not a good way to go. They're going to decide what you're going to get and what your child is going to get. And God forbid your child come into the foster care system because you've lost all control then.
John Ewing.
I believe the mandate is very similar to auto insurance and other forms of insurance that you're required to have. And I've said from the very beginning that that's how I view it, that it should be a requirement, that it should be a mandate, because what we don't need is for people who can afford insurance not to purchase it. And then when they have an illness, when they go into the hospital, they then actually are going into an emergency room, which is much more expensive than a emergency care center or other services that are available. And it actually is part of the reason that our health insurance actually accounts for about 17% of our gross national product. That is larger than any other industrialized country in the world. And what we need to be looking at is how we bend the cost curve so that we actually begin to see that decline, so we have less of our gross national product going to health care. When we have that, then we have an opportunity to be able to invest that money in other places to be able to address some of the other needs we have in this country. So I believe it's critical that we look at how we are going to bend that cost curve. And also, we have to remember, this adds about 30 million people to the insurance program that otherwise would not have insurance. So I think it's a great program. We need to look at how we make it better. but it is an effective program.
A response, Gwen Howard?
I would say to you, we need to spend a little more time looking at the positive things that are included in this bill rather than simply focus on what we feel may be inconvenient or may not be something we would prefer. This bill allows you to keep your adult child on your health care coverage until age 26, which is very, very important, especially in these economic times. It's hard for kids to find jobs coming out of college. It's not like when I came out and I knew I could get a job in social work. This allows your child to stay on to age 26. In addition, it takes out the parity, the difference for women, and I think my time is up, and there was one more I'll tell you the next time.
You can finish your sentence.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you. Let me stop and think now. It takes out the, I know what it was. It's if you have a pre-existing condition, don't get older because you're going to end up with a pre-existing condition, that it'll be covered. And what a relief. I can tell you the many, many people that have contacted me in my office, we can't get insurance. We don't know what to do. Thank you.
John Ewing, you get a little extra time, too.
Thank you very much. I also believe that it takes and reduces some of the discrepancies we see when it comes to insuring women versus men, things that have no logical reason other than insurance companies can get away with it. And at the end of the day, this should be about people, not about insurance companies, not about insurance companies being able to take advantage of you because of your sex or because of your age. This should be about quality health insurance for the people of America, addressing their health issues, and even looking at how we do preventative care better in this country, because right now far too many people don't have access to preventative care, which is actually one of the ways you bend that cost curve that I was talking about and begin to reduce the overall cost of health care.
A question on international relations. John Ewing, should the United States intervene militarily in Syria?
No. We have got to stop being the world's policemen. We cannot continue to do nation building all around the world while we have things like the sewer separation issue in Omaha that's going to cost all of you a tremendous amount of money. We have those issues all across this country. Birmingham, Alabama actually filed bankruptcy because of that issue. But we're willing to do nation building in Egypt and help repair their sewers. That's just backwards, ladies and gentlemen. I hate to say it, that's just stupid. We can do better than that. We need to make sure that we are doing what's best for America. We need to get out of Iraq, wrap that up, and we also need to get out of Afghanistan as well, because we cannot continue to be the policemen of the world and have so much of our military being strained to the seams busting, and seeing things like we saw with one of our soldiers who had been deployed 3 times.
Gwen Howard?
Thank you, Gary. I'm gonna broaden this a little bit to include Iran. It's hard for us to stand by and watch atrocities happening in other countries. It's painful for any of us. You don't have to be a social worker to feel that concern. But what we're doing, for example, in Iran is we're using strategic thinking rather than boots on the ground. We are looking at sanctions, and possibly some countries are looking at sabotage and dealing with what is going on in Iran. This is a serious threat. This is a serious threat to us. And if we're going to look at going into another country, our own security and safety should be a primary concern. But having said that, putting in sanctions that make it painful for a country's economy, and that's what we're doing in Iran, to operate on an international level is a far smarter way. Cause them the pain internally. It's a far smarter way than sending our young people over to be in harm's way and in the face of a bullet. I think we can handle this. We need the cooperation of other countries. We need to stop using their oil, and we need other countries to go along with us. The European nations are on board with us right now, and starting in July 1, those sanctions from the European countries will be in place. The countries that still need to get on board, Japan, China, and India, which, interestingly enough, are countries that we've outsourced our jobs to, and they're using much more of the Iranian oil. We need to make that uncomfortable for them to continue doing that.
John Ewing, a response?
I will just add as well that I, too, believe that we need to make sure that we stay out of Iran. We need to make sure that we always look at economic sanctions, diplomacy, and all those measures to avoid going into war unnecessarily. The first response should not be war and putting our young men and women in harm's way. I have a brother who served for 20 years in the Navy. I have a sister who served in the Army. My father served in the Air Force. I know how important it is to take care of our men and women.
Gwen?
One of the hardest things that I had to do two summers ago, was to name a street after Adam Herold, who had been killed in Iran, a 23-year-old youth. I thought the least we could do for him and for his family was to remember him by renaming Webster Street that ran, just a short segment of Webster Street that ran between Cathedral and St. Cecilia's. Cathedral was his church. St. Cecilia's was his grade school. Now the kids come out of school, out of St. Cecilia's, and can look up and see his name. But we shouldn't have to do that. We shouldn't have to rename our streets for those that we've lost.
You know, we're not done with Iran yet. This is a little different take on it. Gwen, this goes to you first. What if Israel, on its own, bombs Iran's nuclear facilities? Would that automatically draw the United States into the conflict? And what should the U.S. response be?
And that is a real worry. That is a concern. I don't think we should automatically jump into any situation. Israel is our friend. Israel is our longtime friend and will continue to be our friend in the future. We can be supportive. We can be available. Hillary Clinton is over trying to negotiate things to really put a lid on the conflict, if that's possible. But these two countries may engage in war, but we don't need to be on the ground. We don't need to be supplying our young people to that effort. There are other ways that we will be supportive, and I think it's an effort we're all going to have to join into if that happens.
John Ewing?
I do not believe that it means we should automatically go to war. I believe we should work first very diligently with Israel, who is a friend of the United States, who is one of our greatest allies, to prevent them from bombing Iran. I believe that's the first task that we have to try to undertake, is to make sure we do everything we can with diplomacy, assuring Israel that we will be with them throughout this whole process, but making sure that we do not automatically go to war. I think we need to continue the economic sanctions. I believe they're working. I believe it's a great opportunity to show the world a new United States and how we're going to address these types of issues rather than automatically going to war. I believe we have to use diplomacy. We have to use the sanctions. We have to use our allies. We have to get people who aren't cooperating to actually cooperate so that they, too, understand the significance of this long term rather than just looking at whether or not they get oil today, because at the end of all of this, we cannot continue with nuclear proliferation. However, we cannot always go to war and commit our young men and women to fighting.
Response? Gwen Howard?
Well, I will say to you again, we are smarter than simply jumping into action. Even though it's friend and even though we want to be supportive. Right now, one of the sabotage methods that's being utilized is to throw their centrifuges off so that they're not able to function building the nuclear capacity that they need in order to build a bomb, to bomb other countries. And when we have the technology to do things like that, we should be using that every opportunity we get. Throw off their capacity for building bombs, and I keep watching her. She keeps holding up signs for me, and operate that way rather than to send our young people into war.
John Ewing, any response? Okay. Next question. the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline from Canada into the United States. As it now stands, the U.S. State Department is responsible for the governance of international pipelines, but some in Congress want to change that, at least for the Keystone XL. Should the U.S. Congress take over that decision-making process? And if so, do you see how it can be done in a proper and thorough manner, John Ewing?
The U.S. Congress should absolutely not take over that process. There is a reason that the State Department is responsible for it, and it's because we're dealing with an international company who wants to do the building of that pipeline through the center of our country. And the State Department is the best place for that particular decision to be made. I have a great deal of trust in Hillary Clinton and what she will do, as well as the people who are in those positions to carry out their job. I also believe that our current representative messed it up big time when he started trying to tie approval of the pipeline to the tax cut for working men and women. And I came out very strongly opposing that and called the World Herald and other news organizations many times to let them know that I thought that was interference, I thought that was inappropriate, and I will never do those types of political gamesmanship where you put the president or someone else in a position like that and then stand between the people and a tax cut. I believe those are two separate issues, and you needed to approve the tax cut for the people, and then you deal with the pipeline.
Gwen Howard?
You know, anyone can say anything regarding the pipeline, but I'm in the position where I go down to Lincoln and I push the button. I push the button red or I push the button green. We had a special session last November. I'm sure you all know about that. That was called by the governor, and people have given him great acclaim for doing that. But I say to you, the acclaim should stop there. He did call a special session. We did the heavy lifting. And I give a lot of credit not only to the body for the work that they did, but for the speaker. The speaker worked diligently, Mike Flood. And he's a Republican. I have no problem with giving him credit because it's sure due to him. Now, regarding congressional authority over this, absolutely shouldn't. This shouldn't be used as a political game, and I think that's what Lee Terry has done. Local control, local control, local control. We need to make the decision about where that route's going to be. Now, what we've done so far, we passed two bills in November, LB4 regarding the Keystone Pipeline that exists right now, LB1, and that regards any new pipeline endeavor that'll come into this state. We have another bill that'll probably be heard on the floor next week. It's LB1161. It's been prioritized by Jim Smith. Now, LB4 makes TransCanada reroute that pipeline at least 100 miles from the most dangerous area of the aquifer. Now, that's in progress. Now, due to Lee Terry's, I'll just use the word interference, that new routing study was stopped. We need to start that up again. We are investing money. We are investing our state dollars in that. But I'll tell you this, with the amendment that was passed last Tuesday night, we're going to get that $2 million back if that TransCanada doesn't follow through on that part of the deal. But I say we should approve the pipeline here in our state prior to the federal government entering in.
John Ewing, 30-second response.
The one thing I'll state for you again is that this election is about leadership. The pipeline's original route was made public in the summer of 2008. It took our elected officials who were responsible for the governance of this and addressing this issue over 3 years to provide any leadership, any guidance. Had I been in any of the positions that Senator Howard talked about or in Lee Terry's position, I would have been taking action in the summer of 2008.
Thank you, John. Last question. We are coming close to the point where we're running out of time. How, and Gwen Howard, you have this first, how are you different from your Democratic opponent in this primary election?
You know, thank you, Gary.
Well, let me continue.
I'm ready to answer this, my friend.
What would you bring to Congress that, in your opinion, your Democratic opponent would not?
You know, I have to tell you this, and I didn't interrupt at the end of this last comment, but I have to explain that I know how the legislative, judicial, and executive branches operate. And there's a complete separation of power in these branches. This wasn't with the legislative branch prior to our entering in November of last year when the special session was called. This was in the hands of the governor strictly. The governor's agency worked for the governor. The governor's agency were in charge. This was their job, to work with the pipeline and approve this route so that they could give it to us through legislative bills. And then we work on the issue. It's not the governor comes, we sit down and have a little chat and say, well, you know, we have some concerns about this. No, these bills come in the form of legislation that we deal with and we address. The governor can ask a senator to bring in a bill, and they can make the choice if they're going to do that or not. This bill, the special session was called by the governor. Again, I say the thanks to him should end at that point. We dealt with the issue. We made the hard calls. When it was given to us, our legislative body, we're not in session in November ordinarily. We go 90 days and 60 days. This is a 60-day session. Out in Congress, I know how the process works. It's you have respect for the other bodies, the other legislative bodies. You work in your own legislative bodies. I work across the aisles because that's how we get things done. But you know the process. You learn the process, and you get good at the process.
John Ewing?
The difference between myself and Gwen Howard is that I have executive leadership experience. As a lieutenant of the Special Victims Unit, I saw the issues that were out there, and I worked for the men, women, and children of this state to get things done so that we would be able to protect them from the things that I was seeing. As a deputy chief, I was responsible for homeland security for Douglas, Washington, and Sarpy counties. I was also responsible for all of the service programs that the Omaha Police Department provided. I have also been the Douglas County Treasurer for 5 years and worked across party lines. When I sit down with the other treasurers, there are probably only two Democrats among that whole group. And I'm able to get 92 county treasurers to go along with improving service and being more efficient for the citizens of Nebraska. That's leadership. That's executive leadership, where you can cast a compelling vision, you can sell that vision, you can get buy-in, and you can get the things done for the people that you serve. That's what we need in Washington, D.C. today. We have enough people who are legislators. We have enough people who are debaters. We have enough people talking about what they disagree on. What we need to find are people who can build consensus and get things done.
You know, we've got a little bit of extra time here. So our responses, Gwen Howard, and John Ewing, we're going to be a minute timer. So response, 1 minute.
Thank you. I'm glad to have this opportunity to respond to this. I will say to you, I've gotten more legislation passed in seven years than Lee Terry has in seven terms. And it's a fact. And I went into some hard battles. As I said, my first bill I got passed was early intervention to keep babies from being hurt and coming into the foster care system. It doesn't get better than that. You don't want babies injured. You don't want them coming in to be a part of the system. I worked very diligently across the party lines to get the home repair sales tax taken off. This was critical to my district. Older homes, people wanting to remain in their homes, they didn't need the additional burden of a tax on their properties when they made major repairs. I worked with, at that time, the Revenue Committee was made up of many Republicans, and I had to sell them on the idea. I had to convince them why we needed to do this. Got the home repair sales tax taken off first. Then, on the next year, got the repair sales tax taken off for business. The legislation I've passed has all been to benefit us, whether it's anti-bullying, whether it's the move over bill on the highways. These are things that make our lives better, and that's where I'm at.
John Ewing?
No offense to Gwen, but it's easy to beat zero. Lee Terry has not gotten any legislation passed in 7 terms in Congress. So Lee Terry has been particularly ineffective as a member of Congress. So I think it's very clear that he should be replaced. I believe I'm the best person to do that because I wasn't even in a legislative position when I saw what needed to be done and got it done for those men, women, and children that were impacted by the things I saw as the lieutenant of the Special Victims Unit. I wasn't in a legislative position when I was able to get millions of dollars for homeland security for the people of this community so that you would be safe and so off at Air Force and SAC Stratcom would be safe. I did those things because leaders see the issues and they get things done.
How about some applause for our candidate?
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard the first of 2 special programs presenting debates between the candidates running for nomination to the United States House of Representatives from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District in the primary election on Tuesday, May 15th. Today's program has featured a debate between the 2 Democrat candidates. The Republican candidate's debate will be heard tomorrow at 12 noon on KIOS-FM. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, March 23, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The participants in today's debate have been the current Nebraska State Senator from the 9th Legislative District, Gwen Howard, and the current Douglas County Treasurer, John Ewing. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee, as well as the Omaha League of Women Voters for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.